Oh, good morning, everybody. It's great to be here again. The story of Esther. It's an amazing book, an amazing story. And one of the challenges for me as a preacher this morning is it's 10 chapters. And I can't read it all. And so I'm just going to play you a little YouTube video clip, which is just a short, condensed version, just 3 minutes and 10 seconds of the story of Esther. So enjoy. It's not too bad a summary of the story, 3 minutes, 10 seconds. It does a pretty good job. But there's a few things that it leaves out, and there's a couple of things that it adds. And I think the things that it adds are actually quite significant. Does anybody know what they are? Who's read the whole story of Esther recently? Some of you? Two things that it adds in. One of them, it mentions the name God. The whole book of Esther, 10 chapters, does not mention God once. It doesn't even mention prayer, although it does mention fasting, which is often associated with prayer. But the clip has both of those things, God and prayer, which are not in the story. And so Esther is far from your typical biblical or religious book because of those things that it leaves out. I think quite deliberately. They're in a sense, a ploy, a plot, a technique of the author. Probably a man, we don't know who it was, but he deliberately leaves out God. So you might ask, well, why is it in the Bible? And I guess my flippant answer is it's there because God wants it there. But we'll perhaps consider that a bit more later on. The story is set in this amazing city of Susa. You can still go there today in modern Iran. It's now called Shusha. And it was the winter capital of the Medo-Persian Empire, which was the major empire of the time. It stretched from northern Sudan and Africa right through to Pakistan and India. Huge empire. They say on a population basis, it's still the largest empire that's ever existed. And at the start of the story, which is one of the bits that the video leaves out, we meet King Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, as he's called in the Persian language. And it's interesting that we know quite a lot about Xerxes and his empire, not just from the biblical record, but from a Greek historian who was actually called the first sort of modern historian, a man called Herodotus, who wrote at the same time. And he tells us quite a bit about Xerxes. He says that Xerxes had a particular affinity for woman and wine, as we see in the story. And in this first chapter of Esther, Xerxes hosts this amazing big celebration which lasted for 180 days. Herodotus also tells us that at the time, the Persians were fighting an on-again, off-again war with the Greeks. And it seems that this 180-day festival, it was almost like a world fair, was a way of sort of rallying the troops and building support for the ensuing battles. And in the final 7 days of the banquet, at the end of the celebration, Xerxes, who was probably fairly drunk at the time, requests that Queen Vashti be brought to display her beauty. Shake her booty in modern terminology, I guess. And interestingly, Vashti refuses. Again, another feature of Esther is that there are a lot of actions by different characters that are never explained. And Vashti doesn't explain her actions, and the book doesn't even make any guesses at it. Modern feminist writings have suggested that she was really an early champion of women's rights. But we don't know why she actually refused to display her beauty to her husband and the others gathered. And I want to say, ladies, listen up. If you want to get a very negative reaction from any man, make him feel a fool or belittled in front of those that he respects. Great way to get a man angry. Well, several years later, Xerxes is having regrets about his actions and his banishing of his lovely wife. And his advisors suggest that they mount an empire-wide beauty contest to find a replacement queen. And Mordecai hears of the king's search, and he sees a golden opportunity to better himself and his family. Well, that's my take on it anyway. Mordecai had an adopted daughter called Esther, or Hadassah in Hebrew, and she was very beautiful. And she was actually his cousin, but she had lost both of her parents, and so he had adopted her, and she became his daughter. Now, this was the time in Jewish history that we call the exile, a time when many of the best and the brightest of God's people had been taken as captives from Jerusalem to Babylon. Mordecai was one of them, a Jew living in a strange foreign land. And if you read Psalms like Psalm 137, you know, by the waters of Babylon, we get a sense of the pain and the anguish of the Jewish people having been taken into exile, away from the nation of Israel, away from the temple, away from their beloved city, Jerusalem. Now, Mordecai is described as living in the citadel of Susa and as being at the king's gate, which indicates that he was probably part of the administration, probably a civil servant. He was a man who had very much settled down in the nation of, or in the empire of Persia, something that the prophet Jeremiah had told them to do, you know, sit down, plant gardens, marry, give your daughters and your sons in marriage. You're not coming home soon. You're going to be there for a long time. And I guess partially to avert discrimination, Mordecai had kept his identity as a Jew secret. Although, as we learn later on in the story, it wasn't a complete secret to everyone. And so Esther is taken to the palace of the king. And after a year of beauty treatment, she's selected to be the queen. An amazing transformation for this young girl, going from obscurity to a position of opulence and potential influence. And often when people preach from the book of Esther, they take what they call an exemplary approach. In other words, they see Esther and Mordecai as these great heroes of the faith. You know, these wonderful people, these exemplary examples of how we should act and how we should be in the world. People of faith and courage. Examples that we should emulate. But was that really the case? Was it really the case? I mean, Esther was probably very, very young. I mean, the historical record tells us that young girls, women, married typically at age 12 to 14. Women were obviously very subservient to men. And they basically had to follow the wants and the desires of the men around them. And as the adopted daughter of Mordecai, Esther was probably little more than a pawn in the game of self-advancement being played out by her father, her adopted father. Now, to be honest, that's my assumption. The book doesn't tell us that. Because along with never mentioning God, as I said before, the writer never mentions the reasons, the motives behind the various actions and reactions of the people involved. And again, this seems to be a very deliberate ploy on the part of the author. So here we see a young woman, 12, 14 years old, maybe 15, probably quite vulnerable, entering this unimaginable world of wealth and power and opulence in the household of a very powerful but very lecherous man. And I couldn't help but think of some of the parallels in our own century, our own time. And I thought of the thousands of women from poor families in countries like Thailand and the Philippines who are handed over by their fathers to unscrupulous men who traffic them into brothels in places like Bangkok or into the households of wealthy and powerful families in Saudi Arabia or Lebanon, where they are used and abused. I mean, you just need to talk to Steph Christensen about the lives of some of those women. And no doubt their fathers try to soothe their consciences by convincing themselves that their daughters are going to be better off and will have greater opportunities. But truth be told, it's often just a means of advancing their father's ambitions and their family's economic interests. That's often how it is. And perhaps that is how Mordecai justified his actions. But it must have raised some really challenging issues, some really challenging questions for him, particularly as a Jew living in exile. Because for the Jews, there was always the question of how do we live in this strange land, this foreign land, a land where the religious beliefs and values and practices are just so different from our own. Do we maintain our unique identity? Do we be loud and proud about who we are? But like Christians at Gloria Vale or the Hasidic Jewish community in Brooklyn, New York. I saw a fascinating Netflix documentary on the Hasidic Jews in New York and how their life is so different. They live this completely isolated life in the midst of this, you know, amazingly cosmopolitan city. They wear different clothes. They worship differently, different music, different songs, just quite unique. And most people would see them as strange and weird, just like most people in New Zealand see the Christians at Gloria Vale. as strange and weird. But they're both responses to that question. How do we live in a strange land? Do we wear the same clothes? Do we follow the same cultural practices? Do we do what everyone else does, not drawing attention to ourselves, not rocking the boat? And it appears that's what Mordecai had done. He didn't want to rock the boat. But over one issue, he was prepared to rock the boat. He wasn't prepared to bow down to this powerful man, Haman. He won't bow down to the number two big cheese in the empire of Persia. Again, we're not told why. Was it pride? Was it vanity? Was it ego? Or was he like Daniel 120 years before, who had also publicly refused to bow down to the statue of the emperor Nebuchadnezzar because he saw it as idolatry? We simply don't know. What we do know is that Haman took the snub very, very badly. And it started the train of events that led to the king's edict that on a particular day, all of the Jews were to be killed. Now, the author has given us one small clue as to why Haman had it in for the Jews. Anyone know what it was? One small clue, just one word. Haman was an Agagite. And when the Jews heard that name, immediately the memories would flood back of King Agag and of the Agagites. They were Amalekites, and they were the traditional enemies of the Jewish people, the nation of Israel. And so when the storyteller informs us that Haman was an Agagite, it would bring back to those early readers all of those memories of this historic conflict. Now, I don't have time to tell you all of the background, but Agag and the Amalekites were the first people to attack King Saul in the emergent nation of Israel. We see that in 1 Samuel 15. And even before that, the Amalekites had the dubious distinction of being the first people to attack the Israelites when they came out of slavery in Egypt. In fact, this conflict can be traced back perhaps even further to the first encounter between Adam and the serpent in the Garden of Eden, when God said to the serpent, "And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head, and you will strike his heel." One of the biblical commentators, Karen Jobes, says this: "History has shown that there is a force at work in the world bent on destroying God's people and thwarting God's promises." And so what we see being played out here in the conflict between Haman and Mordecai is an archetype of the conflict between God and Satan, between all the powers that support God and all those that are arrayed against him. A conflict that would have its defining battle 480 years later in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, when finally Christ himself crushes Satan's head. Esther is part of this bigger story, a universal story about the battle between good and evil. And I guess the big question for Mordecai and for Esther and for all of the Jews was, what will God do? Will he do anything? Will he save us? Or have we blotted our copybook too much? Have we gone too far from his purposes? Have we sinned too much? Has he written us off? Has he made the covenant null and void? And Mordecai himself must have been asking himself, is this all my fault? Is it my actions, my moral failures that have brought about this catastrophe? You know, it's sobering how being faced with disaster sometimes allows us to see our past actions in a much more realistic light. Human beings have a huge capacity for self-deception. And driven by greed or pride, we can convince ourselves that almost anything is okay. I often have the guys out of the prison who say, "Oh, you know, Padre, I'm really a good guy. I'm really a good man. You know, those guys over there are pretty suspect. I'm a good guy." And I always look them in the eye and say, "The man who says he's good doesn't know himself." I mean, when somebody once said to Jesus, good teacher, what did Jesus say to them? No one is good but God. None of us are good. Not one of us. And for Mordecai, an honest assessment of his own life would have told him that he was seriously morally compromised. I mean, he was the one who made the decision to send Esther into this immoral sexual relationship with the king. And even when she married Xerxes, she was going against every fundamental value of her religion and culture by marrying a pagan. And you can't blame Esther. She was just a kid almost. She was just a young woman. It was Mordecai. It was his plan, his purposes, his agenda that was being played out through Esther. He was the one that was at fault. What's more, many of the Jews in exile had made similar moral and spiritual compromises. Could they now only expect the worst? Had God deserted them? Were they all going to be destroyed? But of course, that was not the end of the story. Earlier on, Mordecai coincidentally overheard a plot to kill Xerxes, and through Esther told the king, thus saving the king's life. Now, at the time, Mordecai wasn't rewarded. He might have had his nose put out of joint by that. But later, the king, coincidentally unable to sleep, just happens to read in the book of the Chronicles of his reign how Mordecai had saved his life. And so he sees to it that Mordecai receives, finally, some recognition. And Haman is exposed for the evil, conniving, nasty man that he is. And he's unceremoniously executed, coincidentally on the same gallows that he had built for Mordecai. And through Esther's courageous actions, the Jews in Persia are eventually saved. And to this very day, all of the Jews celebrate the festival of this great reversal in the fortunes when they celebrate Purim. You've probably heard of that festival. And Purim unusually means lots. It's almost sort of a gambling term. And it's associated with the throwing of a dice. And you may remember another detail in the story. Again, it isn't in the video, but it's in the Bible. When Haman and his cronies threw a dice or a pur to decide when the Jews would be killed. And the dice indicates that it should happen in Adar, the 12th month, the last month of the Jewish calendar, meaning that Haman will have to wait 11 months, nearly 12, before his evil plan can be carried out. Even more ironically, the edict commanding that the Jews be killed goes out to the four corners of the empire. Amazingly, apparently they had an amazing postal system throughout their 127 provinces. And the edict goes out on the 13th day of the first month of the Jewish calendar, Nisan, the first month and the very eve of the Passover celebration. So there's all these little details in the story of things that happen apparently coincidentally that all add to the intrigue and the irony of the story. Coincidence after coincidence. Or are they coincidences? Are they coincidences? No, they're not. Let me tell you a story from my own life, and I might have mentioned this before in one of my previous sermons, and if I have, forgive me. But back in 1984, long time ago, Esme and I were preparing to go to Papua New Guinea to do missionary work. And we were booked to leave at the end of January in 1985. And one of the practical problems we had was, what do we do with our car? We had this really nice, actually, really good condition, Wolseley 1800, beautiful car, leather seats. But it wasn't a popular car. It had an automatic gearbox and an east-west motor. Guys will know what that's all about. And I thought, what do we do? We needed the car right up to the time we left, but we also needed to sell it. And I thought it could take quite a while to sell it, and I expected to take a big hit on the price. We'd paid $1,500 for it, but I didn't expect to get anything like that. So anyway, I think it was sometime in November, Esme might remember better than me, she was driving down to the church, and it was raining cats and dogs, typical nasty winter weather in Wellington. And just as she braked to turn into the church, coincidentally, a car ran in the back of her. It wasn't a serious accident, and she was still able to drive, and we kept the bonnet closed with a bungee cable. And the insurance company, State Insurance, seemed to take ages to get it all sorted out. But eventually, just before Christmas, they decided they would write it off. What were we to do? We needed the car still. So we said to State, well, look, can we hang on to it for a few more weeks? And they said, that's fine. And so for the next few weeks, we drove it. And about 3 days before we left New Zealand, I took in the keys and gave them to State Insurance, and they gave me a check. For how much? $1,500, the exact amount that we paid for it. I went round the corner to the travel agents, bought the tickets, and off we went. I mean, how do you explain that? Coincidence after coincidence. And you know, the skeptical mind says, well, that's all it was, just an amazing coincidence. But when you look through those sorts of things, through the lens of faith, we see the hidden hand of God quietly working in the background. So was it just a coincidence, that accident, or was it part of God's plan? I mean, that raises all sorts of other philosophic questions. I mean, what about the poor guy who ran into us? What about him? Did he have insurance himself? Don't know. But we're faced with similar questions in the story of Esther. Is this intriguing story where God is not even mentioned once? Were all these events just coincidences? Or does the absence of God in the story say something else powerful and poignant? Charles Spurgeon. Heard of Charles Spurgeon? Tim has, Bill has. Great British preacher. He told a story once. He said, we've all had the experience of going to an art gallery or somewhere else and seeing a portrait on the wall of some particular person. And sometimes the artist is not very good, and the portrait or the likeness of the person is so poor that they actually have to put the name of the person underneath so you know who it is. But he said, sometimes you see a portrait and the likeness is so compelling that you immediately know who that person is. You see the image and you say, that's so-and-so. You don't need the name underneath it. You just know. And I think it's like that with the book of Esther. God doesn't have to put his name in there. He doesn't have to write his name in the book. You see all those events, you see all those coincidences, you see all that irony, and you just know it's God. You know it's God. So what appears to be a coincidence is in fact the working of God's unseen hand. And as I said, when you can view those events through the lens of faith rather than the lens of skepticism, we catch something of the majesty and the awe of a sovereign and providential plan of God. A plan that's been worked out through history and through people. Not perfect people, but ordinary, sinful, everyday people like you and I. People who make compromises and who are trying to fit into a very secular pagan world around us. And we don't often do that very, very well. And we look at Gloria Vale and we think, well, that's not me. And we look at the Hasidic Jews and we think, I could never live like that. And so we make all of these compromises and we just try and fit in as best that we can. And sometimes we do it very, very badly. But God is still at work. Of course, that raises other very big philosophical questions. The question of free will. Did Esther and Mordecai really have a choice, or were they just robots in God's great scheme of things? And so finally, I just want to turn us to a pivotal verse in chapter 4, verses 13 to 15, three verses. And Mordecai says this to Esther. You probably have heard it many times. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. And these verses very elegantly hold two truths in tension. On the one hand, they speak of the sovereignty of God. His purpose will never be thwarted. His plan will always be accomplished. That is what we believe. That is our faith. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. In one sense, God didn't need Esther. He didn't need Mordecai. He could have done it another way. He could have gone around the back door. But he chose to use them. And if Esther had choked, that sporting term, you know, isn't that what the All Blacks did in the World Cup? They choked. If she had failed to rise to the challenge, God would have found another way to save his people. That was a certainty. That is what his sovereign will is all about. But the second truth is that our free will decisions are part of God working out his plan and his purpose in history, if we allow him to work out his plan and purpose in history through us. Our actions are not insignificant. We don't need to be fatalistic. We don't need to throw our hands up and say, oh, well, I don't really matter. It doesn't really matter. God will sort it out anyway. I'm insignificant. My actions and reactions are of no purpose. Like Esther, we need to grasp the nettle and step up to the plate when we are faced with situations where we have to make those hard decisions, when we have to, in a sense, be willing to rock the boat. We have to be willing to step up and allow ourselves to be part of God's greater plan and purpose. It might be part of that great conflict between good and evil, you know, when we have to stand up and say, no, that is not right. I will not do that. I mean, there have been a number of incidences, particularly in countries like Britain, where people, often women actually, with strong Christian convictions have done things and said things that have resulted in them being marginalised, discriminated against, losing their jobs. Some of them have been placed in incredibly difficult situations, but they did it because they believed that this was a key issue where God is calling me to step up, to face a challenge, to do what I know to be right. And I'm sure those women or those men or whoever would tell you, I haven't always got it right. There have been areas where I've compromised, but on this, I will not compromise. What did Martin Luther say, Tim, as he nailed the theses on the door at Wittenberg? Here I stand, I can do no other. Our actions are not insignificant. And if we, like Esther, will grasp the nettle and step up to the plate, God may use us in powerful, life-giving ways that benefit those around us, in our church, in our community, in our nation, and even in the world. We may be living comfortable lives, not much different from the secular society around us, but there will be times when we have our own opportunity to step up, to rise to the challenge before us, in spite of the fact that we often stuff up and miss the boat along the way. And even if these opportunities come accompanied by difficulties or tragedy, we have that amazing promise of Romans 8:28. We know that in all things God works together for good, for those who love him and are called according to his purposes. So who knows but that you have come to your position in your family, in your school, in your university, in your church, in your workplace, in your committee, in your community, for a time such as this. Amen. Let's pray together. Father, I can think of all sorts of times when I haven't grasped the nettle, when I've remained silent, when I haven't done what perhaps in my heart of hearts I knew that you wanted me to do. And Lord, those things are in the past. I can't change them now. I can simply say, Lord, I'm sorry. Forgive me for those times when I wasn't the person that you wanted me to be. But Lord, all of us have a present and a future, and we don't know how long that is. But in the time that you give us on this earth, in this life, may we somehow find the courage, the tenacity, the perseverance, the grit to do what this young Jewish girl did, this young, scared, frightened Jewish girl. May we rise to the challenge that you give us to be the people that you want us to be and to do what you want us to do. Amen.